WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This book begins with an essay on Bob Dylan and ends with the story of her recent confrontation with the religion she was born into, Judaism, a confrontation provoked by her brother's decision to study to become an Orthodox rabbi, and this challenge to her to investigate the possibility of the existence of God with the same energy that she devotes to exploring political and feminist issues. Her new book covers many of the key cultural and political issues of the past decade, the legacy of the counterculture of the 1960s, reconciling rock music and feminism, the shifting attitude of the left towards the family, moralism and pornography, and abortion and the anti-feminist backlash. She describes herself as having moved up from lower middle-class origins via an Ivy League education. Though she assimilated some upper middle-class values, she describes herself as having veered off the conventional success ladder into bohemia in the 1960s. Ellen Willis's new book is called Pieces of a Decade, Beginning to See the Light, and it's just been published by Knopf. Ellen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
There's so many things I want to talk with you about, so I thought, well, why don't we start talking about the family. You say that you see a rise in tension between married and single people, and I wonder how you see that tension manifesting itself.
Well, I mean, I think that it exists sort of in a whole context where there's been an enormous conservative reaction to the 60s counterculture, which emphasized, among other things, finding alternatives to conventional family relations, you know, which is to say marriage and conventional sexual morality. One of the things that happened was that since the whole system, in fact, didn't change, people found themselves without any really satisfying alternatives to the traditional forms. And now a lot of people have sort of given up the battle to find them and have gone back. There's been very much a backlash in favor of conventional marriage and conventional family life. And the tension that I find between, for instance, myself and a lot of married couples is that I'm still trying to live differently and do something else. And I feel that there's an enormous lot of pressure on me to not challenge conventional marriage and family, to admit that, in fact, it's the best way to live. And, you know, I should say that I think within the society we have now, there really is no best alternative, that whether you're married or you're not married, each situation has its advantages and disadvantages, and they're both, you know, kind of different ways of coping with the situation we find ourselves in. But people who are sort of committed to different solutions, or to, at least to sort of trying a different way, that I think there is a lot of tension over that.
You talk about how a lot of people on the left have changed from, like, blaming capitalism for the formation of the family and now blaming capitalism for the demise of the family. Can you talk a little bit about, leftist ideology and the family and how you see that having shifted?
Yeah, in fact, I think this is the left, which sort of has really been uneasy with sexual politics and feminism, has only wanted to talk about capitalism, tries to see any issue that comes up in terms of capitalism. In fact, I think capitalism neither has caused the family nor caused its demise, but in fact has affected the family really in different and contradictory ways. I think the rise of capitalism, which made wage labor possible, which made it possible for the first time for women to work outside the home and for children to leave their parents, and took over many of the economic functions of the family, has sort of definitely changed and weakened the family as an institution. You know, at the same time, at this point, it sort of also has the opposite effect, which is that particularly in a period of capitalism that's like very insecure, where people are really worried about inflation and losing their jobs, it makes people sort of cling all the more to sort of the idea of the family, whatever's left of it, and encourages a kind of return to the family, even though in fact the old family can't really be restored. And I think the left has sort of basically not really understood either of those two things very well.
I think a lot of us are always just looking around the neighborhood and our friends and the people we know to see how well feminism and the family can match with one another. In your experience looking at your people, how much success have you seen of feminism being workable within a family relationship, division of home responsibilities and not, you know, the woman not having to bear all the emotional burden for whether the refrigerator has food in it or not, and all the larger issues that go along with that?
Well, again, I think it's sort of important to make a distinction between the way sort of people loosely use the word family to kind of mean, say, any community of people bringing up children, maintaining a kind of intimate network, you know, supporting each other economically. And that idea, I mean, I think not only has great appeal, but finally it's an absolute human need to have that. But I'd like to make a distinction between that and the institution of the family, you know, which is really a particular way of organizing those needs. And historically, the family has been very much a means of enforcing the subordination of women. I think, in fact, the very idea on which the family is based, which is that the biological parents, you know, mother and father, are the and their children are the chief social unit, and that it's the biological parents that have both responsibility for and authority over their children, and that the rest of the community doesn't have that responsibility, nor do children have any kind of really independent status in the community, really inherently works against women, because what it means is that since women are the childbearers, it's sort of up to the woman to have the burden of proof of making some man acknowledge his paternity and be the father. And the sort of historical answer to this has been marriage. Marriage sort of establishes who is the legal father, who has this responsibility. And because men are in an advantageous position, the marriage contract itself has been very much biased in favor of men, you know, with the traditional contract being basically men offering financial support in return for domestic work and so on. And where the real contradiction, I think, between feminism and this institution of the family comes up is that feminism is always inevitably has the result of weakening the marriage contract, because what happens is that women begin to demand both equal privileges within marriage and the right to leave it on better terms, to be economically independent. And what this does is sort of really weaken marriage, increase the divorce rate. Men have fewer privileges, and so they become less willing to take on the responsibility of being fathers. And there's a sort of a mass defection, you know, as we know, of divorced fathers, for instance, from supporting their children. And this creates a very unstable and untenable situation for bringing up children. And then people look around and say, you know, oh my God, there's all the social instability, the family is breaking down, and women are to blame. And you know, and immediately there's a backlash against feminism. And I think that finally, ultimately, the only really way out of that contradiction is really to find kind of alternative forms of family that are more communal, you know, in which the community at large or larger groups of people at least take responsibility for children and not only the biological parents. So that whether one is married or not, if a woman has a child, she should be able to assume that this child will have the support, you know, the moral and financial support of the community, you know, whether or not she can get some specific man to help support it.
Do you think that for just like two people living together, that there's a qualitative difference between being married and just living together?
Yes, I really do, because I think that living together is a relationship, and marriage is a social contract, and that there's sort of very much a tension between these two things. I mean, I think finally, a sexual and emotional relationship can only be spontaneous. A commitment can only be based on real feeling, and marriage is essentially based on the idea that one has an obligation to live with this person and sleep with this person, and I can't think of a worse damper on passion than that idea.
Well, you know, we're kind of taught to really appreciate the values of romantic love and to go and search for it, and then when you find it, to settle into marriage, and then we're taught that like passion develops into something else in marriage, and you know, even if the passion's, it's immature to give up on a marriage because the passion's gone, mm-hmm. and that it mellows into something more adult and therefore better, mm-hmm. and that you have to accept that if you're an adult and wise.
But I think so long as we have the present system where really the welfare of children still to a large degree depends on couples staying together, whether they like each other or not, and the economic inequality of women still makes women dependent on marriage, essentially you're going to have that confusion between relationships based on obligation and relationships based on real freedom, which I think you could only have in a society and culture that where the economic system is much more democratic.
Well, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the subject of the essay which concludes your new book, and I just want to introduce you before we get to that. I'm talking with Ellen Willis, who writes for The Village Voice, and 10 years of her collected essays have just been published under the title Beginning to See the Light, Pieces of a Decade. The last essay in the book is about her encounter with Judaism. Her brother had become went to Israel where he was studying to become an Orthodox rabbi. And Ellen, at some point, you were basically challenged by your brother to investigate the question of, you know, is there a God? And if there is a God, does one have any choice except for becoming religious? And when I was reading the essay, I was interested in the fact that the question to you was so compelling that you did for a while drop everything and go to Israel and put yourself into that situation and force yourself to investigate and confront all these questions. And I'd really like to know why it was so compelling that you took up that challenge and you flew out to Israel and did the whole thing for a few weeks.
I think at the time I went, and at the time even when I wrote it, I wasn't exactly quite sure why. And I think, therefore, the piece is very sort of ambiguous on that question. As I sort of look back on it now, I think I was sort of going through a period in my life where I kind of really needed to test all the assumptions that I'd taken on. Basically, the very kind of radical and utopian assumptions that had kind of really formed my adult life, and particularly feminism, and the idea that there really was a possibility of that kind of social transformation, and that we had to, in a very radical way, break with all the old values of this culture. And then I think this all happened in the middle 70s. A period began where the energy of the cultural radicalism of the 60s really had sort of given way to an enormous reaction against it. And I think that I felt very confused and like very much caught in the middle. And I think just at this point, my brother, who's like 9 years younger than I, had kind of grown up with the counterculture as an assumption, you know, rather than, you know, I grew up in the 50s and it was a big revelation to me. He grew up with it as an assumption and was sort of never really comfortable with it and was very restless. And when he got into religion, it wasn't merely religion, but it was the most absolutist form of religion, really the equivalent for Jews of what being a born-again Christian is for Christians. And, you know, it was almost like the absolute polar opposite of everything that I believe. Essentially, he was sort of reaffirming that these sort of age-old, conservative, traditional, patriarchal values are really the right ones. And I think that I felt the necessity to somehow really explore that possibility to its limit in that way in order to really be able to go on and reconfirm the values that I have. And I think it was sort of very important to me in that way. I think one of the things that I realized in the course of that experience was that I had some kind of sort of very deep need or temptation toward the desire for a moral certainty, which is really not possible. That is, if you really believe in freedom, you finally must accept uncertainty. And I think that what happened when I sort of finally left Israel, and I left really in the state of the most extraordinary confusion, sort of really not knowing what I felt, but just this sort of instinct that I ought to get out of there and go home. In a certain way, it was like an acceptance of uncertainty. That, you know, I just simply had to sort of somehow rely on, after thinking things through and everything, I, in the end, had to rely on my intuition, basically, and that there was sort of never any way of tying up all the loose ends, you know, and being sure, absolutely sure, that what you were doing is right.
Well, one of the questions you were hit with by one of the rabbis who you had met was, you know, how can you leave until you find out if there is a God or not? And, well, if you find out that there is one, how can you possibly go then? So it's a kind of impossible situation out of it. If you apply logic to that logic that had been created for you to work within.
I mean, finally, of course, there's no, you know, the existence of God is not something that can be proved or disproved by logical argument. Although my brother and the people that he was involved with, who are like very, who sort of deeply believe in rational argument as the main approach to dealing with all these cosmic problems, will insist that you can prove that there's a God. Ultimately, when pressed, they will admit that, well, all these arguments can take you to the point where you can say this is probably true, but then somehow in the end your intuition has to take over. And I think that finally, fundamentally, the difference between Orthodox Jews and me is that basically I believe that we don't live in a dualistic universe, that there's no such thing as the natural and the supernatural, that there's no division between the material and spiritual. It's really it's really all kind of one order and one harmony. And they feel that, you know, God or spirituality is in some sense transcends nature. And ultimately, you can't argue that. You either believe it or you don't.
The culture that you were living in while you lived in Israel was a very non-feminist kind of culture where women spend a lot of time at home taking care of the children, preparing food, and the men spend a lot of time studying and praying and coming home and eating the food and partaking of that. What role did you give to yourself? Because, I mean, here you are a feminist in this situation that doesn't really apply, and did you decide to, like, give up operating on your terms for a while and try theirs and see what life would be like for you?
Well, I think finally it was a matter of that they were really challenging my terms. I basically believe that men and women aren't fundamentally different, that we're all human beings, that whatever the differences may be, that the ideologizing of those differences into this polarity between masculine and feminine natures and spheres and roles is really a deformation of human character, you know, and particularly inevitably leads to the subordination of women, because part of the masculine role is to have power and authority. And they are operating essentially on very different assumptions, you know, first of all, on a basically authoritarian, you know, assumption in the first place, which is that your the purpose of your life on Earth is not to simply to develop your own capacities for, as human beings or whatever, but to live in accordance with God's law. And men and women have different roles to play in this task. Just a sort of a diametrically opposed philosophy, really.
In that philosophy, women usually have a lot of children, and the idea each child is a blessing, and it's not something to be looked on as a burden or something that's going to limit your freedom. It's a blessing and should be taken as such. How did you meet up with that interpretation of bearing children as someone who has intentionally so far had none?
Well, again, if you look at it from their point of view, you know, which was, again, the opposite of my point of view, when you sort of deeply believe that, you know, this is really your purpose in life. And I must say that Judaism, you know, which is a very perfectionist religion, encourages women not to only have children, you know, but also to continue to develop themselves in other ways, you know, except the children in the home, you know, are the central and necessary part of it. You just sort of look on on life as a, in a completely different way. I mean, the things that I would think of as diversions from what I really want to do, and, you know, I'm very passionately involved in my work as a writer, and in this society, at least, there's enormous conflict for a woman between being involved with other kinds of work and rearing children. For somebody who, you know, deeply believes that the most important thing you can do is sort of bring new souls into the world, then the conflict is resolved.
Although you've rejected the idea of becoming religious, you still identify yourself as being Jewish and are still very interested in Jewish issues and the Jewish left and Jewish culture and write about it frequently. And I'd like to know what it means to you to be Jewish but to not be religious.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Jewishness is not and never has been only a religion. I mean, originally, you know, the Jewish people were a community, a nation of a sort, that had a way of life, a legal system, a religion. And in the modern world, with the fragmentation of that kind of society, these things have sort of essentially been separated. And so the problem of what Jewish identity is one which, of course, Jews argue about all the time. And there are many Jews who would say, well, you can't really be Jewish unless in some way you relate to religious tradition, you know, or religious culture. For me, the essential fact about being a Jew has to do with history. That is, everyone who's a Jew, once one finds out that one is a Jew, you realize that you're connected with this particular people who has this particular history. And it is, among other things, a history of oppression, a history of being a pariah people, a history of taking upon itself a certain kind of historical, moral, religious mission. The messianic vision, I think, is ultimately on some level the basis of my radicalism. And the question then comes up, well, how is one going to relate to this? There is no way of not relating to it. Either you can try to avoid it or reject it, you know, or even convert to Christianity or whatever, but there's no way one can simply not be Jewish. And for me, being Jewish has really meant kind of trying to confront what that means about who I am and my situation in the world. And I think that confronting anti-Semitism and asking what anti-Semitism means is a very important part of that. And I think a lot of Jews think of this as negative, you know, as seeing your identity in a negative way. But in fact, I think it isn't. Sort of once you begin to ask yourself, you know, what is the source of this historical hostility toward Jews, which has made Jews aliens in every country they've lived in, and then you look at the kinds of things the Jews were preaching and the kinds of things that they represented to people, and you realize that, you know, in a certain sense, I mean, Judaism in practice has been a very conservative religion, but in its basic impulse, there was like a radical impulse to change the world. And Jews have been despised and rejected as being subversives and not fitting in and not bowing to any human authority. And, finally, I see the kind of mandate of being a Jew for me is to really be an uncompromising radical, which doesn't mean attaching yourself to any movement that comes along that calls itself left or revolutionary, but which means a kind of commitment to sort of really get to the root of things and really seek the truth and figure out how to change the world in a better way. And that, among other things, means making a radical critique of the religion itself, because the religion in practice and as it has historically developed, is not identical with the original impulse behind it.
You know what I think has made a lot of Jews uncomfortable about focusing on anti-Semitism is that for many Jews who, say, grew up in the New York City area or in large urban areas, there was knowledge of a lot of anti-Semitism against the people as a whole and throughout the history of the Jews. But in the present, a lot of Jewish people found themselves growing up in comfortable middle-class environments in communities that were largely Jewish, in which there was no, within that community, real discrimination, because it was a very nearly homogeneous Jewish middle-class kind of community. And it became, I think, for a lot of people, hard to understand what all the fuss was about when immediately you could see a lot of really horrible discrimination happening to people around you in the present. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think that there are two things that are really important, one of which, the main thing of which is that anti-Semitism is something that basically, I think, exists like under the surface all the time. Part of the very quality of it is that it's something that's not acknowledged, and I think it sort of has very deep psychological roots in people's in kind of sadistic feelings that people really don't want to acknowledge, and that therefore it's repressed. And when it comes out is always in times of political crisis, when there's some kind of, you know, basic political crisis that can somehow be blamed on the Jews, and it sort of legitimizes people's anti-Semitic feelings. I think that anti-Semitism does exist all the time, even when there's no or very little overt discrimination. And I think that, you know, just as there are many women who before, you know, or right when the feminist movement started, insisted that, well, they could see that other women were discriminated against, but they weren't personally. Really, the whole idea that we haven't personally suffered from anti-Semitism is a form of resistance to consciousness. Because, in fact, if I look at my life, which did involve basically growing up in the middle class and in New York, in which there was sort of very little overt discrimination or economic disability, nevertheless, as a Jew in all sorts of ways, I was vulnerable. And in some sense, especially in terms of the country as a whole, an outsider. And yet I was never like very conscious of anti-Semitism until I started to run into it, ironically, on the left. And sort of had to ask myself what this was about.
What was the nature of it on the left?
Well, the way it first started, the way I first confronted it was anti-Zionism on the left, you know, which is to say the position that Israel simply shouldn't exist. And I remember when I first confronted that, I hadn't really thought much about the Middle East at all. I hadn't really thought one way or the other about Israel. I hadn't really thought about the Palestinians. And so my sort of first reaction was, to feel uptight. And my second reaction was, well, I should really study up on this, you know, and find out about it. And the more I did find out about it, the more I realized how uncomprehending of the Jewish experience, you know, was the idea that Israel should simply be wiped off the map. And I think another thing that happened in the late 60s was a number of black nationalists made various anti-Semitic pronouncements. And among people on the white left, the reaction was, to put it very crudely, shut up, we need them, we don't need you. And that there was no criticism or protest. And that bothered me a lot. And I think that was sort of the beginning, those things were kind of the beginnings of me looking at the issue in a conscious way.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that your identification with Jewishness is unpopular amongst some of your peers now?
Well, I think that there's a much more of a consciousness among Jews and among left-wing and radical Jews of Jewishness than there was 10 years ago or 12 years ago, simply because there really is more anti-Semitism now, and it's sort of inescapable.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm talking with Ellen Willis, who writes for the Village Voice, and she's visiting Philadelphia on the occasion of the publication of her new book, which is a collection of essays from about 1967 to the end of the 70s, and it's called Beginning to See the Light, Pieces of a Decade. It's published by Knopf, and she addresses many different subjects within the book, from religion, feminism, music, popular culture, abortion, the anti-feminist backlash, the family, and many issues pertaining to the left. And I'm going to switch subjects on us again. You're talking about backlashes, and certainly I think there's a strong anti-feminist backlash now, and that's being manifested in many different issues. Why do you think now, you know, at this time, the right has become as strong as it has and the anti-feminist backlash has become as strong as it has?
Well, as far as I can see, there are two things that have really contributed to this. One is that essentially it's a tribute to the fact that the feminist movement was so powerful and so appealing, but that nevertheless the kinds of changes that feminists were advocating were so implicitly revolutionary that they couldn't really come about without a major transformation of the society. And I think people get scared when they contemplate that, and that in itself is partly a source of reaction. I think another thing that's been crucially important are the economic changes, the economic problems the society has had really kind of in the wake of the Vietnam War. We've had gradually rampant inflation, a shrinking economy, high energy prices, all of which has made people's lives much more shaky, and that always causes people to try to cling to whatever sources of safety they can see around them, and has made people very vulnerable to the right's kind of nostalgic appeal to a 19th century kind of stable family that of course doesn't really exist anymore.
Let's look at the abortion issue. And you said that the way things are stacking up now, fetuses are being valued more than women's lives. Why do you put it in those terms?
Well, I think when you say that a fetus has a right to life and that abortion is murder, what you're saying logically, because at this point, fetuses, a fertilized egg, in order to be born, must grow inside a woman's body for 9 months. The woman must nourish it and nurture it. It's undoubtedly the most intimate relationship one organism can have with another. And so what you're saying when you say the fetus has a right to life is that women have an obligation to nurture this life, and that women who don't are murderers. And what this really boils down to is finally this traditional idea that basically women's purpose and function in life is to have children, you know, is to be the nurturers. And women who want to be free human beings, active agents in the world, you know, which involves being able to control your reproductive process and whether you have children or not, are unnatural women, bad women, and murderers in the sense that they kill the sort of feminine altruism, you know, on which our whole culture has been based. And so I think that the whole argument is, on the one hand, an attempt to sort of not talk about women and concentrate on fetuses, but basically it has an implicit view of women and also of sex.
Well, tying in with that, a lot of people who are part of the anti-abortion movement say that, you know, any woman should be prepared to accept the consequences of sex. And, you know, if you engaged in sex and you got pregnant, there you go, you're pregnant, and you've got to accept those consequences. Do you see this as being like an anti-sex movement also?
Yes, you know, I certainly do, and I think the two are very closely connected. I mean, first of all, you have to realize what somebody is saying when they're saying essentially you shouldn't have sex unless you're ready to bear a child. Sexual satisfaction is a basic human need. I mean, women have gone to the barricades before to prove that it's as much a need for women as it is for men. And also, sex is essential to love relationships. So, you know, what essentially the right to lifers are saying is, you know, make a choice. If you want to have a sex and love life, you can't have autonomy. And that's essentially what has always been said to women. Again, in order to be a woman, to be female, to be sexual and to love as a woman means accepting a certain traditional role. And if you're not willing to accept that, then you're not allowed to have this. And in very concrete terms, what they're saying to heterosexual women is that unless you're willing always to be vulnerable to the chance of having a child, you know, because no contraceptive works perfectly, you shouldn't have any sex life, any love life. You shouldn't even get married and have children because, you know, what if you decide you don't want to have any more, then you'll have to get divorced. You know, so essentially they're saying that the price of, if you really insist on this freedom, the price is complete social isolation. And of course, it's a very hypocritical argument because they know perfectly well that most people aren't going to choose that. I mean, they can't possibly choose that.
You're outlining all these hidden agendas within the movement, but for the people who are busy debating when life begins and testifying that it begins at the point of conception, do you question their motives? Do you think that underneath they really consciously have the other hidden agendas that you're talking about, or do you think that that's maybe unconscious?
Yes, I don't think that they're even so hidden, because, as I said, I think that the very idea that the fetus has some kind of absolute human right to live, you know, to grow inside a woman, really implies this whole view of women. And as soon as you start arguing with the right to lifer who makes that argument, you know, they will admit that. I think, you know, the argument over whether life begins in itself is really sort of an enormous red herring, because, you know, for centuries, people haven't been able to agree on when life begins in a moral and psychological sense. I mean, in some sense, the fertilized egg is alive. It has a biological blueprint, you know, to become a human being. But is a fertilized egg a person in the sense that it can think, talk, feel pain, act, make choices? Obviously not. Well, you know, when does that egg, in the process of being on its way to be born, develop those characteristics? You know, your guess is as good as mine. And I think that, to me, you know, it seems to me that birth is a good way of making that that distinction, you know, of calling somebody a full-fledged person once they're born. But no matter what one feels about when exactly life could be said to begin, nevertheless, the question of stopping that life, you know, of killing that life, is not, to call it murder is already making a judgment that it's not self-defense, which is what I would call it.
People would say you're selfish by saying that, right?
Well, I think people have always called women selfish for wanting to live their own lives instead of be completely sacrificing their lives to other people's needs.
What is your role as being, you know, how do you feel like you can be most effective? This is obviously an issue you feel very, very strongly about, a very pivotal issue. You've written about it. Do you see your role as a feminist and as an activist going beyond what you write about? Like, would you want to be participating in a march or writing your congressman? Like, what kind of action do you feel like you should be taking?
I am participating. I've helped to start a group in New York called No More Nice Girls, which is a group of militant feminists who came together because we felt that nobody was really taking a militant pro-feminist, pro-abortion stand, bringing up the issues of freedom and sex and putting it in the forefront and not being afraid to offend people by, you know, really talking about what the issues are. And, you know, basically I believe that the only way to fight effectively is to really tell the truth about what the issues are and put it very strongly. And people who have been in the abortion rights movement have in fact sort of been very defensive and apologetic. And, you know, they talk about the right to choose, but, you know, the right to choose what? You know, they're afraid to even mention the word abortion, let alone sex. And the effect this has on people hearing this is subconsciously they think, well, if they're, you know, feel nervous about even mentioning abortion, if they're not really willing to come out and really strongly defend women's right to abortion, if they don't even believe in what they're saying, why should I? Whereas on the other side, the right is fighting very, very passionately for its view of the world. So, you know, what our group is doing, you know, is essentially what its name says, which is that we're making a big fuss and, you know, we're putting out all these arguments in a very public way.
Were you putting them out?
And our first action was at the International Psychoanalytic Association in Italy had a conference on sex and language at the Plaza Hotel in New York. And we got dressed up as pregnant women in black dresses and chained together with a huge banner that said, forced childbearing is a form of slavery. And that sort of got quite a bit of attention. and we're planning other actions for the future.
It's interesting. I guess the women's movement started off, you know, as a really radical movement and then became accepted and integrated into the lives of many people who didn't want to be and wouldn't consider themselves radical, but learned a lot from what started as an extremely radical movement. Do you think that this might also have that kind of effect of affecting people who wouldn't want to be as outspoken and as radical as you are, but who could borrow from what you're saying and doing?
Well, we hope so. I mean, that the whole idea is to, by taking the radical position, you move the debate. You affect the terms of the debate. And I think people who aren't willing to go along with you all the way will nevertheless be willing to listen and be influenced by what you say, even if they're not willing to go along with the whole thing.
It's impossible for feminists to get together without talking about pornography and what it means, what its implications are in the real world where real acts of violence against women are committed, and what the appropriate stand should be. So let's talk about that a little bit now, but I'm just going to reintroduce you again and say that I'm talking with Ellen Willis, who writes for The Village Voice and whose new collection of essays, Beginning to See the Light, has just been published by Knopf. What do you think of the stand of groups like Women Against Pornography, who say that pornography leads to real acts of violence against women and that therefore pornography should be suppressed?
Well, I mean, I think that they're really on the wrong track in so many ways that it's sort of almost hard to begin. I think, in the first place, that the criticism of pornography from a feminist point of view is not a new thing, that the women's liberation movement from the very beginning criticized sexist and misogynist images of all kinds, including the sexist and misogynist images that show up in pornography. This is really different from like having a single-issue movement against pornography, which sort of doesn't, first of all, make distinctions. There's really a wide variety of material that could be classified as pornography, and there's always the question of who's doing the classifying. Women Against Pornography would like to define pornography as essentially sadistic pornography or violent pornography, but even they, in fact, you know, when you really ask them, well, is this pornography or is that pornography, will stretch their definition to things that I don't think are sadistic or violent, or things that I think are like legitimate depictions of sexual activity, only pointing up the fact that this is sort of an enormously subjective area. And essentially what a movement against pornography inevitably does, even if it doesn't come out full square for censorship, is to strengthen the forces of the right, which are coming out for censorship of all sexually explicit material. Whether or not they mean to do that, that, in fact, is what they're doing. And that is, like, very much against the interests of women, because finally the people who are going to be defining what pornography is are, you know, the kinds of people who think our bodies ourselves are pornographic. And the moral majority is already mounting a campaign to get, quote, pornographic materials out of the libraries, out of the schools, off TV. And essentially what this means, the conservative view of pornography is that is any explicit depiction of sex, sexual dissidence, feminism, or homosexuality. And it's, obscenity laws has been one of the great means of suppressing information about sex of all sorts. I also think that the anti-pornography movement is really mistaking symptoms for causes. I think that the way to fight violence against women is to fight sexism and the institutions that produce it. I think that the whole question of does pornography cause violence is in a way a really sort of meaningless question, because you can say that anything, any kind of fantasy that's public or anything that's in the media, in the air, influences people in some way, if it's sort of only gives them an idea of how they can sort of focus their violent fantasies on a particular fantasy. And so I think that I think that violent pornography contributes to a climate where violence against women is acceptable in a certain kind of sense. But I think that when you that you can't have a little free speech. It's like either you have it or you don't. And I think that, you know, racist propaganda and anti-Semitic propaganda contribute to a climate where racist acts and anti-Semitic acts are more acceptable. Nonetheless, our society does draw a distinction between fantasy and reality, speech and acts, and I think that on balance, it's a proper distinction that free expression, along with the greater risk that this free expression contributes to an atmosphere which will cause acts you don't like, is still better than suppressing free expression, which ultimately makes it impossible for dissidents to organize and, like, always works against us. And so as a woman who is, like, not, you know, certainly doesn't favor violence against women and is, in fact, you know, quite freaked out by being confronted with violent and sadomasochistic pornography, nevertheless, I prefer to defend pornographers' right to express what they choose in order to be able to more consistently defend my right to organize as a feminist and to talk about sex in the way that I choose.
This is an issue where everybody finds themselves being in being an ally of an uncomfortable partner. The women against pornography find themselves being an ally of the moral majority in many circumstances. And the people who say, well, let pornography exist because it's too risky for free speech to do otherwise, find themselves being a partner of the people who create and distribute pornography depicting violence against women. Mm-hmm. Does that partnership bother you in any way?
Well, I certainly don't see it as a partnership, because I certainly, you know, feel free to criticize, you know, the Hugh Hefner's Sexual Politics and Larry Flint's and all these other people. But I think that you sort of have to look at really the way this society is structured and, you know, what's the main enemy. It's like there's sort of a whole class of activities which I think kind of reinforce sexism that are on the one hand somewhat illicit and on the other hand condoned. I mean, rape is illegal, but it's sort of widely condoned. Pornography is legal, but it's still, like, in some sense emotionally illicit. You know, in fact, this is the basis of its appeal. You know, nevertheless, it's widely disseminated. But these things are still, in some sense, sort of part of an outlaw culture, which whose main function is kind of to scare women into accepting traditional morality and traditional culture. It's like you step out of line, you hitchhike by yourself, you don't have a man around, you might get raped. It sort of reinforces the structure of marriage and family. And similarly, pornography, hardcore pornography, really enforces traditional sexual attitudes, which say essentially, if you're not a good girl, this is what you'll be, a bad girl, and you'll be brutalized and violated. And I think that finally, it's the institutions, the main institutions of sexism, the institution of the family, and the economic suppression of women, and all these things are really the main things to attack. They're like the underpinnings of the society. Violence against women is just sort of another way of kind of upholding these institutions. And I think that the moral majority and everything they represent are sort of much more of a threat, because essentially they're saying reverse all the feminist reforms in these institutions, and this will certainly not lead to less threat of violence against women, because the threat of violence against women is sort of part and parcel of these other institutions. But it does set up a situation where you can tell women the price of your freedom, the price of any attempt to get freedom, is violence. And I think the violence is only a symptom, and it's sort of a wrong tack to make that like the main focus of your politics.
I think some people have accused women who would like to see pornography censored as being too moralistic and as, in a way, falling into a trap similar to the trap of the prohibitionists who went around to bars smashing up alcohol bottles in an attempt to stop husbands from being drunk most of the time. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I mean, I think that it has to do with sort of on some level being hooked into a very traditional feminine idea that women are nice and morally superior to men, and men are inherently violent and predatory and sexually, you know, too sexual. And basically, you know, it all boils down to your old-fashioned moral crusade against male vice, you know, which has never done anything to change the system. It's just a sort of more or less acceptable outlet for women's anger, which conservatives will nod and approve of. And, you know, it doesn't really change anything.
A lot of people would like to separate erotica from pornography. Do you believe that they're separable?
Well, I think, as I said in one of my articles, you know, erotica is what turns me on and pornography is what turns you on. I don't think there's any objective way of separating the two.
You're in the position of disagreeing with people who you would otherwise be in agreement with on a lot of issues. Like, you are a very militant feminist in a lot of ways, but on some issues, like pornography, you disagree with many other feminists. Is that painful for you to be involved in a split with people who you'd probably prefer to agree with?
Sure it is. You know, but I think that their politics on this issue are, like, basically anti-feminist. You know, and so... Yeah, I mean, of course, it would be nice if we just had complete solidarity. I think one of the reasons we are less effective than we could be is that we don't. But I think it's sort of enormously important to have clarity on these issues. Is sort of much more important, you know, if agreement isn't based on clarity and an analysis that's really going to help us get what we want, then it's not worth anything.
Well, the left, for instance, has always had splits within the different groups and individuals who are part of the left. And, I mean, this is a time when everybody, I think, is wondering what's going to happen. Is the left going to pull together? Are feminists going to pull together? Will there be enough unity on enough issues to really mobilize and be an effective force? What do you think, and what are the trade-offs in maybe compromising on some issues to reach that unity?
Well, I think it's not so much a matter of compromise at this point. I think that what's really wrong with the left and why it's having such a difficult time in mobilizing is sort of enormous analytical confusion about what it is we're really after. And I think that the key to it in many ways is feminism, and the left's reluctance, which is never really abandoned, to accept sexual politics as in itself serious and as sort of inseparable from and intertwined with economic issues. I don't think that we can fight at this point unless we recognize that economic and cultural conservatism are going hand in hand, that even the arguments that are made to get people to accept conservative economic policies are moral arguments. You know, like, people have been too self-indulgent. We've demanded too much. We must sacrifice. We must tighten our belts. And this is sort of very connected with, you know, women must put their noses to the grindstone and stop being so selfish and stop wanting freedom. And the economic situation sort of drives people into the arms of the cultural right, and also people's anxieties about sexual roles drives people into the arms of the economic right. And so what the left really needs to do is to really kind of affirm a commitment to democracy in both spheres, you know, and realize that whenever they're talking about economics, they're also talking about sexual politics and vice versa. And I think that what this really involves is people becoming more radical, not compromising. The time for compromise is when people agree on essentials, you know, and at this point, I think there's so much disagreement about essentials that the pressing need is for a debate about, you know, what should be the basic underpinnings of a left fight.
What do you think is holding back the left from espousing feminism, a feeling that it's essentially bourgeois?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the big things holding it back is sexism. You know, obviously, men, you know, not wanting to give up their privileges and not wanting to confront a kind of politics that, you know, unlike what's happening in El Salvador, affects their daily life. And I think another reason is that anti-sexual attitudes are, like, very, very deeply rooted in everybody, including leftists. And, you know, one has the paradox now of a left-wing anti-abortion movement, you know, which basically comes out of Catholic and Christian pacifists who come out of a religious philosophy which has been very anti-feminist and anti-sexual. So there is that contradiction there. You know, on the other hand, they're sort of, quote, progressive on other economic and foreign policy issues. But what they don't realize is that their politics are a complete contradiction, because unless you support sexual freedom and women's rights, you're not going to create the kind of social atmosphere in which people will be willing to fight for their economic rights.
You've used the word utopian a few times during our conversation. What are some of your utopian ideals or utopian fantasies?
Well, basically, I think that the measure of a good society, you know, or the way a society is to be measured, is to the extent to which it can replace coercion and hierarchy with freedom and self-government and voluntary association. And although it may never be possible, I mean, I think utopias are almost impossible by definition, because it implies something that's finished, a process that's finished and over with. And I think in terms much more of a process of a self-liberating process, whereby, you know, for instance, Western society right now has much more democracy in its institutions and much less authoritarianism than, say, the medieval feudal society. And I think more and more democracy is like, really, to me, the way all politics should be judged. You know, will this lead in the direction of greater democracy, greater freedom, greater ability for people to really take control of their own lives, or does it lead away from that goal?
Well, Ellen, you've really addressed a lot of very complicated issues today. I want to thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you
coming
for having
to Fresh
me.
Air and for talking with us. Ellen Willis writes for The Village Voice, and if you'd like to read a collection of her essays from about the past 12 years, really, they're all, a lot of them are collected in a new volume published by Knopf called Beginning to See the Light, Pieces of a Decade. And the subjects we've talked about today, in addition to many other subjects, are addressed within there: abortion, feminism, music, popular culture, the family, religion. And the book, again, is called Beginning to See the Light, Pieces of a Decade.